We have limited amounts of SAF, and the energy use of SAF is higher than the alternatives. We believe it makes sense to kind of save the SAF for those that cannot do anything else. And those of us that can find an alternative will benefit massively from using less energy and perhaps also have less taxation because of a even lower environmental footprint. So we're kind of seeing this as a competitive advantage for the regional segment, where it might be possible to do this in a different way.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. Andreas Kolbay Ux is not just the CEO of Widerøe Zero, he is also the Chief Strategy Officer of Widerøe. Both of these are small regional airlines in Norway that punch above their weight when it comes to sustainability. In fact, Andreas has strong opinions about why his airline does not use or does not believe in using sustainable aviation fuel and instead is betting on long-term technologies like electric and hydrogen to rethink aviation and especially regional aviation. His experiments, for example, the collaboration with Embraer and Eve, are very fascinating, where he will be using Eve's eVTOL to connect remote islands in Norway, which is very different from the typical eVTOL use case we see connecting urban hubs.
Andreas, it's great to be speaking with you again. This time virtually. I am first curious, for the rest of the world who does not know, you of course are running an airline in Norway. What is the difference between Widerøe and Widerøe Zero?
Widerøe Zero was founded last year as a new company owned by the Widerøe Group, where our sole focus is on the new aircraft concepts, hopefully coming out in the next couple of years. Purely focused on sustainability. I mean, we've been working as a group within this domain for quite some time with some extensive research with other partners, being Rolls-Royce, Embraer, and so on. And through that, we learned that we may, as an airline group, have to also be willing to rethink the way we do things when we're looking into new technology. So we decided that it's easier for us to create a new company which can base its business model on the next generation technology combined with expectations from future customers and then design the perfect business model around that. So we decided to create a new company.
Thank you. Let's step back for a minute and go to why this was done. You, of course, operate in the Nordics. Widerøe operates in Norway. And there's a mandate that by 2040, Norway will be phasing out all fossil fuel flights. Talk to us both about the opportunity and the challenges of operating in a regulatory and public environment which is very climate aware.
Yeah, I mean, Norway, and I guess also the same applies to the other Scandinavian and Nordic countries. Focus on sustainability has been high for a decade or more. Last month, I heard that more than 80% of all new cars sold in this country were EVs. 80%, 80%. And this has been pushed by a combination of public measures, political measures, and will from the customers. People are, in general, caring a lot about the environment and want to do whatever they can. You mentioned that, yes, by 2040, we're expected to have all domestic flights without any emissions. And that was put forward actually quite a few years ago now by Avinor, the owner of all major public airports in Norway. They own more than 90% of all airports. And we operate in and out of most of them. As you mentioned already, we, as a company, Widerøe do majority of our business within the country. Beyond that, we fly to the UK, our neighbor countries, and some holiday destinations to the Mediterranean. But in general, and broadly speaking, we're mainly operating within the country. So, of course, this ambition was extremely important for us to focus on and see if we could fulfill. In addition to that, 75%, or to be correct, 74% of all the flights we do domestically are very short. We're talking less than 300 kilometers, which means that we did expect to be a very good and maybe the first big test bed for new aircraft types. Being aware that, okay, when we're talking about hydrogen electric concepts, all electric concepts, range will be limited. So we thought, okay, maybe we have a role to play and maybe we should try to fulfill that role. So it was this combination of political push, expectations from society, but also the fact that we may have a network of airfields in Norway, which is ideal for first generation null aircraft. And those in combination made it very interesting for us to really lean forward and look into this more deeply.
Wow, it seems like all of the different factors coming together to give rise to Vidro Zero. What does this involve and where are you in terms of bringing this to reality? It's been some months or years since it's been launched.
As mentioned in the introduction, we founded Vidro Zero last year, but it was in many ways an extension of the work we've done over the last 2 or 3 years in collaboration with other partners. So we've done some extensive research together with already mentioned Rolls-Royce and Embraer, but also other partners, trying to understand what is doable and what is not from an operational perspective. There are so many promises out there and so much hope, but when you want to invest and in aircraft and design your business around aircraft, you have to be pretty certain that and a bit more realistic in what is possible and what is not. So in the beginning, this was all about understanding what is feasible from an operational point of view. What can we expect at what time? And really try to get our heads around that. Beyond that, we realized in this process of learning with our partners that not only is it going to be a challenge or new, it will be new challenges related to the pure operation of these aircraft with new scales, everything you need to know about new technologies, new processes and procedures, all those things familiar to most accountable managers and those working within operations. But beyond that, we also found it important to understand more about the customer and what is the customer expectation to this, because we have all these hypotheses and thoughts on what they may think about our services, what we hope they think, what we expect them to think in many ways, but we don't really know. So we figured out we have to do also more research on understanding what are the actual customers' expectations to the future of flying. What do they want from us? And when we're talking about different technologies, this is very important because it doesn't really matter what I consider being net zero or a good solution if the customer don't agree with me. We need to understand more about their take on this. Would SAF be okay? Would SAF be just second best? They would prefer a true zero emission solution instead of that. What are their willingness to trade off things? If their travel time will increase by X percent, would that matter? What if they have to bring with them a little less luggage than they did before? All these things which we don't really get a good answer to before we ask the customer. So the other part which we're trying to kind of build in Vidro Zero is research on future customer and mobility systems and how these new aircraft will fit into to a optimal service for the customer. So we're now launching what we call Vidro Zero Mobility Labs, which is a research where we want to really interact with different customers, real customers, exploring their different customer journeys in different regions in Norway to kind of go beyond just asking what they would think based on what they know today, but really explore with them what the potentials are in these new vehicles being developed, being zero emission aircraft, but also eVTOLs. eVTOLs could do a massive job, we believe, in Norway and really expand on the network we know today. But I very often say you didn't really know that you wanted an iPhone before you got to see an iPhone. You were okay with your Motorola or Nokia, right? So we want to explore this.
This is very interesting, right? I want to actually dive a little into the customer first before we get into the technologies. I am a stickler for customer journey mapping. We've done a lot of work with airlines around the world, especially during COVID, on rethinking customer journeys, how they would change because of all the health safety measures. And now we're doing the same work around sustainable travel. The interesting thing is, you're right, customer doesn't have a clue. Most customers in most parts of the world are still sorting by price. Some are sorting by schedule on when they would like to travel. But you hit a wall where you are trying to introduce the world's first, you know, fully net zero airline by 2040, hopefully earlier, way earlier. But the customer has never seen this, right? How do you, what kind of questions do you even ask the customer when they've not experienced this vision before?
Exactly. I mean, that's the challenge you're pointing at. I mean, you can't really just send out a questionnaire and ask people about things they don't have a clue about because they can't relate, right? So we're planning this to be much more interactive. I'm going to set up 4 air mobility labs now in Norway, around the country, from the far south to the far north. The distance between the far south and far north is almost the length of Europe, right? Norway is a long country, so it's a huge difference. And we will also select, in total, four different places. So it will be altogether 4 mobility labs. We've carefully selected them because not only do customers have, we expect different expectations to transportation, but the journeys we expect to be different. Some place of the country you have more tourists, it's more about leisure travel. Other places it's pure commuting. While in other places, more like it's all about cargo, getting things transported and so on. But we want to go out there and really work with them and show to them what we can offer and interact with them. And this is going to be through group interviews and some interactive sessions, because if you just sent out a questionnaire asking hypothetical questions about things they couldn't see or couldn't envision, I'm not sure if you get any reasonable answer. So we want to kind of start introducing to them what the future may look like and then see, okay, if this is the case, what would you then choose to do? And I think this is also important when you want to introduce something new, because it's another question we've asked ourselves. Would people be willing to board a new aircraft with new technology, which they're not familiar with? By doing this, we're also kind of pre-introducing, let's say, an eVTOL by talking about it a few years in advance, preparing the community for what may be the future to them. And I think that's also a very often underestimated barrier, that you actually need to build first public and public awareness and acceptance before you can successfully introduce a new service. So this is also something we want from this, that we want to pre-introduce what can be the future mobility service in the region.
So you're saying that the mobility labs are just as much about education as about and buy-in as about asking them what you want. So this is a two-way process you're trying to do.
Exactly. It's a two-way learning experience. We want to learn from them, but we also invite them to learn from us.
Right. Okay. So there was the regulators and the national environment, which was the initial push. Now they're the customers as well. But the use cases of the customers, like you said, differ a lot. I'm in Canada, and I know in northern parts of Canada or in Alaska, there's the milk run. There are airlines like Alaska Airlines and Horizon that do milk runs, and even in northern Canada as well, where you're right, certain communities only want cargo. That's the airplane is the only way to get essential services and food products to them. Whereas some might be touristy in nature, whereas others, you know, they're just doing day trips, perhaps, just out for the day and then back in the evening. when you have such different use cases, you definitely need different technologies for different passengers. How are you tackling that?
Yeah, I think you're right. And to what extent you would need different vehicles or different concepts, we don't know. I mean, you can't expect to have a tailored aircraft for every mission you want to do, right? So it is also about finding middle ground. But when we are participating in researchers or advisory boards or any other kind of OEM-led endeavor to understand future customers, we very often find that when replying to their questions, we're merely saying what we personally think without having really extended this to what the customer think. But in those processes, it's all about combining the needs and the expectations to different customers and different markets and build a vehicle which has a potential to reach a sizable market, right? So maybe we don't expect to have different vehicles for all the different, let's say, tourist operation, commuter, cargo, medevac, and so on. But maybe there are things we can do to influence design so that they work for more things in the best possible way, at least that we take all these things into consideration at an early conceptual phase. So that's what we're also trying to do. We're trying to really be a good partner for the OEMs that want to develop the best vehicles by getting more insights than average about the customers.
So then let's focus on that. We'll start with Embraer. You have, of course, under Widro operated a lot of Embraer aircraft in the past, and now you are on Embraer's customer board. How does that work? What are the inputs required? How often do you meet? How do you work with Embraer?
You mentioned already we operate in the group now a fleet of Embraer E2s. I was actually responsible for acquiring and entering them into service back in 2008. We were a global launch customer and an amazing project to get with Embraer, I have to say. It took a year and a half approximately, but it entered into service on time. We were so proud, just on time. So fantastic work done by their team, our team, Pratt & Whitney, also fantastic. You say, yeah, we're part of my advisory boards, and I've been part of many advisory boards over the last couple of years. If you're referring now to the kind of novel board, the energy advisory board, and those boards focused on new aircraft, this is, of course, something we find huge interest in, and we're really doing whatever we can to help them finding an aircraft which fits our needs. But also, more importantly, we do appreciate that it will be no sincere focus or any grand development in aircraft which is only interesting to Norway or our use case. So again, this is all about understanding how can we find a way of developing an aircraft together which fits us, where we can be a fantastic first customer, I believe, putting them into service. And we would certainly need, we have a fleet of Dash 8s today, 45 Dash 8s, which we want to replace, so we can be a good first customer. But we do know that Embraer, as any other OEM, would need to produce way more than 40, 50 aircraft to justify such a big investment. So we're participating, trying to give our advice and help them in developing the best aircraft for our needs. And then others, I hope, are doing an equal effort in making them work for their markets.
I'm glad to hear that. Now, one of the aircrafts you have actually ordered from Embraer is the Eve, eVTOL. How does that fit into the plan, and why did you order Eve?
We have an MOU with Eve where we want to explore how the eVTOLs can be used, not so much in a urban application, but more in a rural one. Because the thing is that there is no need in Norway to fly across the city. It takes you about 20 minutes with a subway through the capital of Norway, Oslo. So there is no big need. What it may be a need for is to expand, or there is a potential at least, to expand on the short takeoff and landing network in Norway. We have 40, 45 airports spread out on islands around the coast, which is essential in connecting the rural communities to the big cities. Beyond them, there are many societies on the smaller islands next to them. So people are living spread out on these islands. So on the west coast of Norway, you could foresee eVTOLs being a fantastic way of connecting more societies into the existing hubs, small airports, which we fly in and out with Dash 8s today, potentially Energia in the future. So with eVTOLs, we're talking more about expanding the existing network to more destinations, making the existing airports as hubs. But this is different to maybe what's the core case of eVTOLs, which is all about urban air mobility. And I think to Eve, this was interesting because it was a somewhat different application and something they wanted to look into. So we've already started on that, looking at how can that be deployed and how can it make a maybe different but still very valuable service to the rural communities on the islands in Norway.
Right. Okay. So let's go one step bigger from an eVTOL to the Technim P-Volt small electric aircraft, which I believe you want to have it in service by 2026. Tell us about this aircraft. How will this fit into your network? And is this still on track?
In our work with multiple partners already mentioned, we early figured that it's in the early phase of introduction, size of aircraft and range will be limited. Still, we believe if we want to, in let's say 2030 and onwards, phase in or replace the Dash 8 with novel aircraft, we have to start early. We have to start learning by introducing smaller aircraft, which can come sooner. We also believe that with you mentioned Technam P-Volt, you have also Eviation Alley's 9-seater concepts. I know Embraer, the smaller Energia concepts are 9-seaters. Which can be all electric or hydrogen electric concepts. Thing is that these concepts can be certified and come to market earlier. And many of the flights we do today, even if we fly them with the Dash 8s, are only half full or one third full. And for that reason, we're flying under the so-called PSO regime, public service obligation regime, where we get support from the government to operate them. Many of these flights could be flown with smaller aircraft. I'm not saying that a 9-seater is the perfect aircraft, but they could certainly do a job. And maybe if we combine that with the potential of being early on a first mover, it's interesting. So for that reason, we want to EIS a small fleet of the first to market zero emission aircraft. If that's going to be an Italian or an American or whatever it comes from, we'll see. But we have to be realistic. And I think if we're just waiting for the bigger aircraft to come, we'll already be too late. We need to start. So we're therefore looking into small commuters and also eVTOLs, which can be EIS'd before 2030. We're talking 26, 27, as you mentioned, right? I think that's the same expectation Eve has with 2027. So we really want to be part of that wave as well. And test out smaller aircraft, because we certainly believe we have good cases for them. And it's important to be part of this journey already in the 20s, not wait till 2035 when you can have a regional size zero emission aircraft.
Right. I'm glad to see the timelines here. You alluded to this earlier, that you're placing a bet on electric, hybrid electric. How are you evaluating these technologies, electric versus hybrid electric versus hydrogen electric? Which is the most promising to you?
Oh, that's a good question. We're basing all our knowledge on what we learn from different suppliers. To me, it seems that when we're talking about the all electric concepts, most players have realized that range and size will be limited. Maybe to eVTOL size or less than 10 seats. We're often talking about 9-seaters with the battery technology we know today. For that reason, we can have this as a base hypothesis that, okay, we're talking small aircraft, short range. Benefit, of course, easier to certify and super energy efficient and easy to maintain and all those things. But but range will be limited and size will be limited. Then we share the interest, as I know many OEMs have in hydrogen electric, where we're talking about fuel cells and still the benefit of a super efficient and almost maintenance-free, I hope, electric propulsion system. And it's also interesting with larger concepts where you may have to use a combustion engine, but it could still be hydrogen if you want to have it zero emission. So I think we're equally interested in all of them. And we've done some quite interesting calculus and research on what it will cost to operate these different concepts. And we're working on that now. We haven't really finalized that work, but we're working on it to understand more about it, how these concepts and how the cost structure of these concepts will differ. Because that will depict how we can operate them and how we can build a viable business.
So still under evaluation phase is what you're saying. You're exploring this with the different OEMs. If we focus specifically on hydrogen, one of the challenges is, of course, infrastructure, both in terms of the airport and transporting hydrogen. And in your case, you serve a lot of remote islands and destinations, like you mentioned. How will you actually meet this challenge? Is hydrogen even a viable option for Widerøe and Norway?
Good question. I think we, in the early phase, when we're talking about a limited fleet flying short, to my understanding, what we've learned from EASA, and I do believe FAA is pretty much following the same timeline, we're talking gaseous hydrogen in the beginning, not liquid. Liquid hydrogen will come later than we are into 2030. With gaseous hydrogen, things are easier. With liquid hydrogen, it's more requirement to infrastructure and so on. So in the early phase, I think this is doable when we're talking about just some... And remember, it's not going to be a big scale in the beginning. We're just going to test it out, right? So I think that is very much doable. And then we'll see. I mean, when we're talking about liquid hydrogen, which I believe is needed if you want to fly a larger aircraft, a regional size aircraft, you're talking liquid hydrogen quickly. Then it's, of course, going to be a bigger requirement to infrastructure. But then again, these aircraft, to my understanding, will not arrive in the market before we are into 2030. So we still have, 7, 8, 9 years to do that. Still, again, I do believe in preparing for this by doing something and learning along the way. So again, we really want to introduce a hydrogen electric aircraft in as soon as possible, even if it's not liquid, just to, again, start to learn how to deal with hydrogen. And I know also some airports have done it the same way. They're saying, okay, we expect hydrogen to be part of the energy mix of the future. So they're investing in that. Maybe they will start by operating their ground equipments on hydrogen just to get into the mode of understanding hydrogen and how to use it and in a safe manner.
Wow. Okay. Again, once again, you seem to be way more open to experimentation and trying out new concepts than most other airline CEOs I have spoken with. Let's talk about something very safe, SAF. You will still, until 2026, 2030, whenever it is you transition, you will still be operating the E2 aircraft, the Embraer jets that you currently operate. Are you pursuing a SAF strategy to handle the current tube and wing designs and of planes as well?
One of the challenges with SAF is the limited amounts being produced. And as long as we are below 50% blend in, all aircraft can pretty much handle it. To my understanding, it's going to take a long time before we have enough SAF to go beyond that, unless it's kind of collected by only a few because they want to have a higher blend. There is no real need for any high blend-ins in the near future. It's most important is to scale up and ramp up production if we want to reach those levels, and it's going to take time before we're there. I think in the time frame we're looking at before 2035, we're okay with just following the mandates, and we understand that SAF will play an important role to many airlines, especially those operating longer haul, medium to long haul. It's going to be very difficult with hydrogen However, one of the reasons why we believe in and want to focus so much on the alternatives is because one thing is the emission. That is, again, what is considered zero emission. Ultimately, the customer decides, right? And perhaps also the politicians taxing us. But beyond that, we need to understand also energy use. Energy is not going to be free in the future, and especially not clean energy. One of the big concerns we have with SAF and then especially electrofuels is the cost of producing them. So cost in terms of energy and therefore money. We do believe that those aircraft concepts, which are more energy efficient, where you can make the best use of energy from well all the way through exhaust, will ultimately win. So the way we see it is that if you can do something different, if you can find a better way, if you could potentially fly all electric where you get 95% out of what you put in, that's fantastic. But we know it's very limited how far you can go with today's technology. Then hydrogen is kind of also efficient, especially fuel cell electric concepts, much more than a SAF concept from well all the way through exhaust. If you add those two together, saying, okay, we have limited amounts of SAF and the energy use of SAF is higher than the alternatives, we believe it makes sense to kind of save the SAF for those that cannot do anything else. And those of us that can find an alternative will benefit massively from using less energy and perhaps also have less taxation because of a even lower environmental footprint. So we're kind of seeing this as a competitive advantage for the regional segment where it might be possible to do this in a different way. And again, back to our role as being a testbed, we find our most important role to play to really pursue those alternatives because we know that the entire industry is working on SAF. So we're focused on the novel technology and the rest can focus on SAF. But we're not against SAF. It's just that we can do something else and we want to do something else.
This is very interesting, right? You want to focus on what the rest of the world is not focused on. To me, from a business perspective, if I was only looking at it as Widrow, this seems like a very high-risk, high-reward strategy. So, you know, let's explore lots of things. Something might work. It's a pie in the sky. But if you seem to be having the vision that you're having, which is let's benefit the entire industry, this is definitely bigger than just Widrow Zero. How are you sharing these learnings or insights with the rest of the industry?
What we're doing now, we've just gotten support from the Norwegian Research Council on the project we're doing, where we're working together with the communities here in Norway, but also OEMs out there. With the community in Norway, we're talking about the local CAA, Avinor, the airport operator, the air traffic management provider, and we're trying to share what is, within the country, what is needed to make this happen in the best way we can. Then we do believe that when we EIS, the first zero emission aircraft here, this is something which will benefit also other markets beyond Norway. Of course, especially within Europe because it's EASA. So when we found a way, you can pretty much copy paste that any other place in Europe and probably elsewhere as well. So but we really want to do this first. You mentioned the risk, and I think it's quite natural thing to think that, okay, isn't this very much more risky? Well, I don't think so. I think it's more risky to not really look into this and understanding the potential here, because SAF is in many people's view kind of an easy target. Okay, this is something we it's a safe bet. We can just do it that way. But long term, if there is a better alternative, they will win. If you don't understand the potential in hydrogen electrics, you may fail massively on your fleet strategy. So I think we're kind of de-risking a lot by trying to really understand the differences and understanding how these two concepts will compete up against each other with focus on energy use, with focus on cost, with focus on taxation. And this is something we debate a lot when I attended the Clean Aviation in Brussels. And to my surprise, I think it was 2/3 voted in favor of hydrogen being where focus should be instead of SAF. So I think more and more people are focused on hydrogen because it's more energy efficient.
Interesting, because there again, like you said, 2/3 voted in favor of hydrogen at the Clean EU forum. I was at a Boeing forum last week in Seattle, and that was all about SAF. It was SAF and SAF, yeah, SAF, right?
In the US, it's all about SAF, right? Yeah.
I'm guessing it's about having a short-term, medium-term versus a long-term vision. And what I'm hearing from you is, let's focus on radically rethinking aviation long-term rather than just focus on what can we do now. And you're saying the rest of the world can focus on what can we do now. We will focus on what can be done in the future.
That's very much right. And again, it doesn't mean we don't want to follow what others do on the SAF strategy, but we think that's a journey which will go without our help. We will certainly follow all mandates. We'll do whatever we are required to do. And we're not against it. We're just saying we have a different role to play. The regional segments, those operating short to medium haul, can do better, and I think we should try to do better than SAF.
Since we've been speaking about hydrogen, I actually had the founders of Zero Avia and one of the co-founders of Universal Hydrogen on this podcast as well. Are you not considering retrofitting your existing fleet or aircraft with some of their solutions?
We're looking into everything, and I know both Universal Hydrogen and Zero Avia very well, and I think it's amazing what they're doing. It's fantastic. My colleague was just over to see the Dash 8 that did its first flight now a few months ago in Moses Lake with hydrogen electric propulsion on one wing. And we've also been following Zero Avia with their successful flights. I think that shows what is possible. When it comes to retrofitting, to your question, question to us remains, what will the OEMs, the airframers of these concepts do when they see this potential? For us to invest in retrofitting is much more interesting if it's supported by the OEM, where we know that this airframe will be in the market and reasonable to maintain for a reasonable amount of time. So the question remains what they will do when they see this potential. If they are backing it, it's much easier to invest in than if they're not. We are facing in our company now a retiring Dash 8 fleet, which we're life extending from 80 then to 120 to now 160,000 landings. But to maintain an aircraft longer than anybody else is challenging, but also quite costly. So to us, it's all about what the OEMs do. If they say, okay, now we believe in the Dash 8 Q400 in hydrogen electric form, fantastic. Then it's an interesting aircraft. But we need to see the OEMs support Universal Hydrogen or Zero Avia in their retrofitting strategy so that we can safely invest in those concepts.
Okay. My understanding is that both of them are getting significant support from the OEM. Like Universal Hydrogen has Airbus as an investor. Zero Avia is working very closely with the Dash 8 OEMs. Isn't that already happening?
I think it is. So, but again, it's to us, just so that we understand. I mean, talking about the Dash 8, it's an aircraft which with the classic series has pretty much come to an end, and the Q400 is still out there. But when you invest in these things, you want them to last for quite a long time. And I know they're working together. We just want to see with certainty that, yes, this is something they're actually pushing 100% together, and that they can kind of guarantee that if you invest in an ATR-72 with hydrogen electric propulsion or a Dash 8 Q400, we know that we can have and maintain and have support for that aircraft for the next 20 years, right? So we're talking long time frame. That's my point.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Okay. Fair enough. Final question. What gives you the most hope for a future of a sustainable aviation industry?
I think what is seeing is believing. And over the last year, we've seen quite a lot of concepts do their first flights. You mentioned already with Zero Avia, Universal Hydrogen, Aviation Alice. It's a lot happening, not to mention all the EVTOLs and eVTOL manufacturers also stepping up the game. I do also, what gives me hope is that, to me, it seems like the industry, although there are different, somewhat different focus, and where you have the most focus in the US versus Europe, I think the industry in general is about to agree on what is doable within the different segments. And then there, it may remain a question where the most focus should be. But still, we've seen, and I think we're over the last 2 years, we've gotten a much clearer view on what is achievable near term, medium term, long term, and with different aircraft sizes. And to me, it seems like quite a lot is possible. Now the question is about how can we make this commercially viable by a combination of customer's willingness to pay plus political stimulus, those two in combination. Either the taxpayer or the customer has to pay. That's how it is. So therefore, we need to understand how much they're willing to contribute.
Which is the interesting part. I think airlines have always faced the conundrum of the right business model. You've had a pre-COVID, a rather large red-faced competitor, which filled up lots of 787s across the Atlantic and to Bangkok and to other places that didn't really get its business model right. This definitely seems like a much more mature approach to me, but it's still a high-risk approach because you're trying to create the future far ahead in advance. So I think perhaps it's the Viking spirit that's coming in here, getting all these experiments going. But it gives me a lot of hope because on one hand, you've got the air mobility labs taking in customer feedback and discussing with customers. On the other hand, you're working with OEMs and sitting on their advisory boards and then really thinking long term. So I love this flip thinking. Everyone's working on SAF. Let's work on something that's beyond. Let's focus on something that's in the long term. Now, the final part of this interview, Andreas, is called a rapid fire round. You have not seen these questions. I will ask you very simple one-line questions, and you give me very simple one-word answers. For example, what's your favorite movie?
Favorite movie? Skyfall.
Okay, Skyfall. And James Bond it is. What's your favorite airline?
Swiss.
Okay, why?
I like the service on board. And I think it feels a bit like home, the way their interior is very kind of cozy to Norwegians. A lot of wood and you feel like you're in a mountain cabin.
Yeah, yeah. And who doesn't like an airline that ends and starts a flight with Swiss chocolates, right?
Exactly, that's a good point as well.
What's your favorite city?
Favorite city? That would be St. Andrews.
Where is that?
Small Scottish town where I studied.
St. Andrews?
St. Andrews, yeah.
St. Andrews, okay. All right. What is something you still want to learn?
Oh, it's a lot I do want to learn. What I'm focusing a lot on now is trying to get my head around and understanding more about energy. Because, and I think this has, unfortunately, become a little bit too interesting and very important to Europe at the moment. But I do also believe that it's going to be in the near future, but also long term, a challenge to get hold of enough renewable energy to do what you want to do. And to understand the energy mix and how we can make the best use of different energy sources in combination with transportation and so on. A lot to learn. And I think the transportation industry in general could benefit from working more closely with the energy providers and understanding use of energy from where it's originally coming from very often we say from the well, from the oil industry. It could be a waterfall if we're talking renewable energy, but from where it origins to where it's ultimately being used, that's something I'm very interested in. And I'm focusing more and more on learning more about energy use.
Okay, I'm intrigued myself now. What do you do in your free time, Andreas?
Free time. If I have a good time off, I love sailing, but that's time consuming, so I don't have the time to sail all that often anymore. But sailing and skiing is my passion, and unfortunately I don't find time all that often anymore, but I love it both.
Okay. Who do you look up to?
I look up to many, many people. And I think I'm one of those persons that find in general interest in people that are passionate about something. When people are passionate, they are very often eager to share their views. And I can't say one person I'm looking up to, but in general, I look up to persons that are very passionate about a topic.
Okay, passionate people. And finally, what is the best advice you've received?
The best advice I've received? Things take time. More time than you think.
Fantastic. I am a true believer in that. In fact, my email signature has this quote from Lao Tzu, which says, "Nature takes its time and everything is accomplished." And that is absolutely correct. Andreas, it's been a pleasure speaking. Thank you so much for sharing some insights and your excitement about the work you are doing to create a new future for aviation. I do wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplifying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our Supervising Editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.